Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, May 23rd, 2013. And first of all, I am sorry I missed last week's show. I was out of radio range, and sometimes that happens. It's very rare that I miss this show, but I apologize for that. And this week I'll hopefully make up for that. I did do a show last week, and I'm going to experiment here. It was a very good show. It was like a half a show, and it was on the Saturn winds. Now, the past week, and really about the last, since the beginning of April, we have had phenomenally bizarre weather. And when I started looking for the cause of this, of course, if you listen to the National Weather Service, weather just happens. There it is, weather. Here it is, weather. And they maybe can predict it, maybe they can't. They do more weather reporting than weather predicting, but they can't tell you where weather comes from. What is the cause of weather? Weather is energy systems personified. It is energy in the atmosphere personified. It is energy, and that energy comes from somewhere. It doesn't just magically appear. It's not the result of solar light energy coming in the atmosphere and the magical movement of clouds, and somehow this forms tornadoes and kills people. No. Weather is caused by energy systems, and those energy systems come from outside of our planet. If those energy systems stopped, if all of a sudden they just stopped, our weather would turn to zero in an instant. It is constantly driven by electrical conditions that are passing by our planet. And what we have been experiencing, as I found out and I've been talking about, is the connection to Saturn. That connection has released now, and we should be getting back to normal weather over the next, we're already back to normal weather. But for a time, the jet stream reversed. It actually, the magnetic field of Earth turned backwards. We had the wind in the northern hemisphere coming from the east. Our typical trade winds come from the west. I mean, typically, always, this is for hundreds and hundreds of years, the equatorial jet stream moves westerly in a standard sense. It always moves westerly. It reversed over the past weeks. The jet stream, equatorial jet stream, was moving easterly, moving east around the equator. And the jet streams were basically wild. The northern snaking jet streams were all over the place, but the ground winds were coming for basically much over a week from the east. Tremendous straight line winds, and of course the tornado systems, there's a flip side to this, because we had a major himicane, that's an overland hurricane, that's a term I coined in my weather book, in my weather work. The himicane is an overland hurricane. We had tremendous himicanes over the past weeks. And by the way, I don't know if any of you saw this, it's not because people have dreams about, I won't even go into it. Weather systems are real energy systems. They come from someplace, they're caused by something. It's not because somebody had a dream. That's going back to the time of the ancient Greeks, when the gods threw thunderbolts and were toying with the lives of men. No, that was an interpretation of what was actually happening in the heavens. But anyway, what I am going to try to do now is insert the show that I recorded last week. And by the way, I was kind of out of radio range. I spent a couple, I won't tell you how long, but chainsawing trees to allow people access to get from some of the storm-ridden areas. And so, but finally, I believe I'm back to normal. But I'm going to try and insert the recording I did last Thursday in an attempt to do my radio show, and was unsuccessful in getting it up to the station. But anyway, I'm going to try and insert that now. If it does not work, well, we'll come back and revisit this. The piece is going to be about 27 minutes long. I hope it all gets in here. But like I say, this is an experiment. If not, we'll come back. The main science topic, I'll be continuing with the topic of spectroscopy, going down to the atomic level. And remember that I'm doing this for a very special reason. I want my audience to be very well educated on the topic of the light that comes off of comets. What's it all about? And you can understand this on many levels. It's kind of like, let's say, a bicycle. There's people who have just a basic bicycle with no gears, and they ride well and they get exercise, or they can go places. And then there's people at the very high end with a, $10,000 carbon wheels, a race bike with all the equipment, and they understand bicycling at that level. So that my audience is very similar. It's the whole gamut of people, everything from grade school kids to who are being homeschooled, I know, or even people who are kids who are in public school or private schools listening to these shows to get a real education where they don't get it at school, unfortunately. But up all the way up to grandparents, and there's truck drivers, and so everybody has their level of understanding. There are scientists, there are PhDs, there's a lot of trained scientists who listen to this show. So they would understand at a level that they could maintain. So at any rate, but it's very important to understand, because when we see a comet, we see this kind of the shape of a comet. And the Dirty Snowball Comet model, which is totally incorrect, the standard model given to you by standard science, only talks about the shape of the comet. What I'm delving into here, based on the plasma discharge comet model, my theoretical work explaining how comets work, the concept is that there are many sources of light in a comet. And you understand, you measure this light by doing spectroscopy. So visual, just taking a picture with a camera is one thing, but digging down deep into that structure of colors and light coming out of the comet is another thing, and that's where you really understand what a comet is all about. So that's why I'm doing this, giving you a bird's eye view into what a comet is all about, because the light coming off is indicative of all the processes going on in the comet, not just reflected solar light. You measure this light, and that's what spectroscopy is all about. It's the ability to measure light, break it down into its components, examine the elements and the chemicals in the comet, and not only comets, but planets or asteroids, etc. So that'll be the main science topic. I will also be talking about the Saturn connection. We have been electrically connected to Saturn for many weeks, and if you have been experiencing these strange and powerful winds we've been having, 30-35 mile an hour winds, and this is typical of springtime, so it's not like this is very unusual. But there's a reason for the tremendous weather systems we've been having, and I get a kick out of listening to the national weather reports. There was one report that we've had fewer than average tornadoes this year, and that May would be one of the larger tornado months, but it's lower than average. But it's because some reason, because the jet streams are not as powerful, as if this is some magical formula. It has absolutely nothing to do with the real cause of tornadoes. The tornadoes are driven by electrical conditions from outer space that come in, and for the most part, we cannot predict these very well. I can predict, for example, using my work, I can predict the energy systems that are there and say, okay, well, now we have a good probability of high energy weather, but it might come down in China, not the USA, as much as we have a big globe here. That energy can come in many ways and in many places. But anyway, referring to the Saturn winds, I defined a term, Jupiter winds. And if you've listened to my shows, last November, we were experiencing the Jupiter winds, the winds that emanate from the Earth weather systems when we connect electrically to the planet Jupiter. And they're typically more powerful. But in typically Saturn, we do not connect very strongly. But this time we are. It was April 28th. When we were at an inferior conjunction with Saturn. In other words, we were directly aligned with the Sun. Now, that's not a perfect date, let's put it this way, because the solar wind and the other magnetic field structures of the Sun don't necessarily come out in a perfect straight line. For short-term use, say a comet is passing near Earth, for short-term use, the direct alignment with the Sun is quite valid. For example, Comet Ison will have a very close direct alignment with the planet Mercury coming up this fall, and I'll be reporting on that as that time comes near, what to look for. Very good viewing up in the early morning sky. I believe that's an early morning view that we're going to get of that particular comet and planet electrical alignment. Very close quarters. But Saturn and Earth, Saturn is way out in the solar system, and many times we don't have any significant connection at all. But this time we certainly are. And it's hard to say exactly why that is. Solar system conditions being as they are, they're variable. And it'd be fortunate, it'd be wonderful if we had many, many hundreds, if not thousands, of spacecraft out in outer space measuring these conditions. And who knows, maybe there are such spacecraft, but in the secret world of Tier 1 science, we would never hear about it or know about it. And, you know, I bet there are. I bet you there are thousands of spacecraft out there and monitoring conditions all over the place, but none of that information coming down to the public. It's all kept top secret in the for the military, the mill boys to have their toys and secrets and their little paranoid secret world out there, which is a farce because the information, the military information, is given directly to all of our opponents, China, Russia. They get all of our information. So it's not like they're keeping it from our enemies. They're keeping it from you, the public. And that's the way it is, folks. You know, you're not going to hear that on the evening news, the schmooze news with whoever's given the schmooze news these days. I don't even watch it anymore because it's too disgusting. And lack of content. But at any rate, the connection we're having with Saturn has been very strong. It's powered the spring storms that we have had, the extended winter, the very bizarre and twisting jet streams that we have experienced, bringing in late winter weather, snowing in Arizona in May. You know, in early May, we had about May 3rd, we had another blizzard. Just actually this past week, we had more snow activity. Where was that? I think it was in Michigan. They had a pretty good snow up in Michigan. Getting a little late season skiing in there up in Michigan. So, but this being driven by Saturn, the planet Saturn, and the Saturnian conditions. So, I wanted to explain exactly how this works, and because I talk about the Saturn connection, the electrical connection, And this all relates to the plasma discharge comet model. It relates to how planets work in the solar system. Here is this. Here's how it works in a nutshell. Just like a comet, Earth and all the planets are discharging the solar capacitor. The solar capacitor is like a battery that is built up due to an excess positive current in the solar wind. This wind of electrons, protons, and other charged particles leaving the sun constantly. And there's an excess current. It's important to understand that term, current. An excess current of protons, positive charge, leaving the sun. That leaves the sun with a net negative charge. And the discharge of this capacitor, everything that's in this zone between the sun and an area really out about twice to three times the distance to Pluto, the outermost planet. So this is a big area around the sun that basically is a charged capacitor. Any object moving into this capacitor or moving within this capacitor is going to be subject to discharging that capacitor. And so Saturn is the same way. Saturn, we see that beautiful planet with the ring system, the beautiful ring system that's visible from Earth. With a small telescope, even, you can see the rings of Saturn. But electrically, Saturn, like a comet, probably extends out the tail of Saturn, electrically extends out probably a half a billion miles, 200-400 million miles out in that region beyond Saturn. The same way with Jupiter. Tremendous power out behind Jupiter. And this is a lineal electric field. It's an electric discharge. Coming from the sun is basically an electron current, and that's the primary charge carrier in this discharge. Earth does this also. So imagine the planets. We can all imagine them going around the sun in their orbits. And when Saturn and, let's say, Earth align, or Jupiter and Earth align with the sun, and like I say, you can imagine a perfect linear alignment. April 28th was our perfect linear alignment with the sun, Earth, and Saturn. But that doesn't mean that's when the real electrical connection would begin. And in fact, it was about a full month or more before that when we actually connected into Saturn. You can think of the solar wind and the magnetic field lines of the sun and the electrical currents of the sun coming out like a pitcher's curveball, where it just swings out and continues to curve. And so we actually connected into Saturn electrically probably late in March and all of the month of April, driving those tremendous weather systems on Earth. So how does this happen? That's the question. Okay, so imagine Earth. It's got its sunward electron beam coming into it. That electron beam continues out the backside of Earth and keeps going. And as it wraps around Earth, it basically does a lot of work in driving our local weather systems up in the ionosphere, and those drive down through the layers of the atmosphere, ultimately leading to the troposphere, what we call a layer of weather, or weather layer on planet Earth, and driving our lower system weather systems. Okay, that electron beam then continues out probably all the way to the orbit of Mars, the next planet out. So that's Earth's electrical size. Electrically, we're a huge, huge entity, basically pointing towards the sun and also away from the sun. Okay, connecting out into that far region of the solar system. Saturn, likewise, has a similar sunward electron current coming out towards it, and then it has its own electrical tail. When these two align, if they have enough connection to start to electrically pass current, okay, now you have the electrical connection. And so the overall electrical current passing through both Earth and Saturn are greater. much greater than normal. Okay, in Saturn, we can watch Saturn, for example, developed a tremendous hurricane system down at one of its poles. Could that have been due to an Earth electrical alignment? Well, the possibility is there. These, what I've tried to do is relate the various something is going off in the studio here. Okay, so what I've tried to do is relate these various events so that we can better understand what causes our weather. It's not just some magical thing where the sunlight comes in and oh, gee, there's weather. There's a hurricane. There's a tornado. No, there's very specific reasons that energy comes from somewhere. It's even gotten so ridiculous in standard science that they are suggesting that a butterfly flaps its wings in the tropics and causes hurricanes. Something so bizarre. It's, I mean, why not me flipping a coin up here if I'm sitting in my room and I flip a coin? Gee, will that cause a hurricane? You know, it's about as logical, you know, and there's no logic back to it. I mean, every time a butterfly flaps its wings, is there a hurricane? Boy, we'd have a lot of hurricanes out there. You can see how absolutely absurd that comes out of something called chaos theory, that everything is hamstrung in chaos, and we can't predict or understand anything is basically the bottom line. But that's a great tier two concept because it can basically keep the public totally confused about real science. Okay, back to the Saturn winds. We have Earth coming around in its orbit. Okay, that was the pre-recorded piece from last week, and about half of that got lost. I'm back live, by the way, right now. It's on May 23rd, and I'm going to continue talking about the Saturn winds. So anyway, Saturn is moving much more slowly in its orbit. Earth is coming around much more quickly in its orbit, so we, in a sense, catch up with Saturn. And remember that something strange is going on. I mentioned this before, that the solar wind does not come out linearly from the sun, straight out from the sun. It kind of comes out like a curveball, like a pitcher's curveball. It swings out. And swings out kind of like a right-hand pitcher's curveball. So it would connect with Earth, and then we would connect into Saturn much earlier than the date, the April 28th perfect visual alignment with Saturn. And that is what happened this year. We connected into Saturn, and I said, wow, I was looking for the energy source of the weather we were having, and I said, this is Saturn. This is the only thing connecting us out there. And I even thought, could there be something down in that lower June region of the solar system, the place where Harrington was looking for Planet X? And it was really too early. That was definitely a connection with Saturn. And so I said, we're going to, knowing that April 28th was kind of the perfect linear alignment with Saturn, I said, wow, we're going to ride this out probably well into May with these connections. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. Now, remember that piece that you just heard was recorded last week before the tornadic activity. And in listening to that again, I think it's noteworthy that the National Weather Service was saying we're having a lower than average May tornado season. Well, it looks like we made up for it in grand style due to the very unfortunate situation of the people down in the mid-USA. And remember that the entire world has been labeled with severe weather. When I pulled up and looked at all of the weather around the world this past week, it was horrific. All over the place. The jet stream reversed. Now, let me talk about that just a little bit here. what does it mean when the jet stream reverses? Now, I have never, in all of my decades of studying weather, I have never seen the equatorial jet stream reverse. This was amazing. When I first saw it, I said, this can't even be true. And I looked at the time stamps on the satellite feeds. I said, this has got to be wrong. There's got to be something wrong here. And so I'm looking at the clouds around the equator, which typically are moving westerly, along with that equatorial jet stream and along with the ionospheric electron belt that moves westerly around the equator. It was moving easterly. What does this mean? Okay, well, these are magnetic fields. These are electron streams going westerly around the equator and ion streams that move up above in the ionosphere, moving easterly, that eventually drive those lower weather jet streams, what we call the jet streams. That's where the jets, 30 to 60,000 feet, sometimes as much as 150,000 feet. Sometimes they come down almost to the layer of the surface of the Earth. So those jet streams weave around the Earth. The equatorial jet stream is very linear, moving westerly, but they reversed, and the northern and the southern jet streams were just wild, going all over the place. The weather systems, I observed one area of the northern United States and Canada where the winds reversed, the trade winds, what would you would call the typical trade winds, coming from the west going easterly, standard all the time. That drives our weather systems were totally reversed. The wind was coming from the east, very heavy, heavy straight line winds for a week, just pounding from the easterly direction. And that was at the same time these tornado systems were moving through central United States, the southern part of that hurricane that just sat there and wound and wound and wound like a big top. So at any rate, things are somewhat back to normal. We have finally dislodged that Saturn connection, and it went out in big, grand style. With the tremendous weather systems that were experienced through the middle United States. That was a tremendously powerful storm system. And let's look at what Standard Weather says about, or the National Weather Service, what do they say about tornadoes in these weather systems? Well, first of all, they don't really say much. They don't say what causes weather, but the sunlight coming in from the sun, it comes down to the surface of the Earth. And remember that when these big storm systems are occurring, most of that sunlight is reflected off and does not get down to the surface of the Earth. So how does this reduced amount of energy create these amazingly powerful storm systems? Well, it's just beyond silly, absurd. If you took all of the state, and this is an example I've given on radio shows, I've given it on my own show, if you took all of the light energy coming in, let's say, on the state of Oklahoma in a given day, or the state of Texas, let's go big, if you took all of the sunlight coming in on the state of Texas on a given day, there would not be enough energy to drive the tornadoes that we see. So where does this energy come from? The first thing is just a basic undergraduate student in physics. The first thing you learn if you learn your coursework well is that you have to account for energy. Energy just doesn't happen. It comes from someplace. The same is true of weather. Weather is energy personified. So when you see weather, especially severe weather, that energy has to come from somewhere. So where does it come from? Well, there's only one place. It doesn't come up out of the Earth. The only place it can come from is outer space. And much of the water in these storm systems also comes from outer space. It's driven in and feeds these systems because much of that water was not in the atmosphere prior to these storms forming. So at any rate, the Earth then connects electrically with Saturn, And as a result, our electrical energy consumption, the electrical current that drives our weather, is increased dramatically. Instead of maybe 100 million mile electrical size of Earth, we are now expanded to a 500 million miles, or maybe as much when we connect out to Saturn, as much as 1 billion mile electrical connection through the solar system. It's no wonder we had amazingly powerful storm systems crossing through the solar, around Earth, and driving our wind systems down here in the troposphere. It's not any surprise to me at all that we had these kind of systems. So end result, I want to get back to the concept of spectroscopy, atomic spectroscopy, but let me just recap the whole issue of the Saturn connection here. The tremendous weather we've seen really for well over a month and a half, almost 2 months, has been a direct result of us connecting into Saturn. And this tells us something about it's a very unusual connection, because typically our connection to Saturn is not that significant, but it really connected in. And by the way, just to review, all of the other planets are in other parts of the solar system right now. All of the small planets, the terrestrial planets, are on the far side of the sun and have been. Jupiter is not a significant factor now, nor is Comet Ison, which is way out still near the orbit of Jupiter and very much not aligned with Earth. So the only thing out there is Saturn. And so really an amazing event where the Earth's jet streams reversed. By the way, I didn't quite complete that thought. When the jet streams reverse, those electrical currents are one of the five layers of electrical currents that make up our geomagnetic field, the plasma magnetic field that is coupled with the physical magnetic field of Earth. And so that means that our magnetic field really reversed. That does not mean the Earth's spin rate changed, mind you. That does not imply that Earth's spin rate changed. It's the magnetic field. And that has a lot to do with our weather. There's a lot of misconceptions out there, a lot of people misquoting pole shifts. There's a lot of people saying, oh, pole shifts could be dramatic, and the Earth could flip. No. The magnetic field, especially the plasma magnetic field of Earth, is very loosely connected with Earth. It's a gas. It's a plasma that is coupled with our magnetic field. But that does not mean that Earth has some kind of a physical flip, where the solid Earth actually flips. No, it does not mean that. In fact, you're going to see, if you could measure carefully, that the Earth itself has not changed significantly in its rotational properties, in its properties related to the physical rotation, the physical position of Earth, the relative position to the true north, etc. Rotational north. No, none of those things have changed. Okay, now I'm going to jump into spectroscopy. Once again, this is an extremely important topic, extremely complicated topic. In previous weeks, I have been talking about spectroscopy of comets in redshift, and I find this really pretty comical, something. I always have to note these types of innuendos, I would call them. Spaceweather.com, because I have been pounding on the standard scientific community that they don't release spectroscopic data of comets. And so here, and especially talking about Comet Lemon, I thought it was more than comical that Spaceweather.com the mouthpiece of NASA and the National Weather Service, that they put up a spectrum, what they called was a spectrum, of Comet Lemon, of all things. But it was a useless, absolutely useless piece of data. Here's why. A spectrum of a comet or of anything else, it comes from visual data. But that visual data then has to be digitized and put into graphic format to show the spikes, the peaks, etc. So for them to put just a photo of a spectrum of Comet Lemon, they may as well pasted a piece of toilet paper on their webpage, because it would have had exactly the same amount of value, literally. So I just cannot believe these people, but it shows they're trying to respond to what I'm pointing out here to you people, that the standard scientific community is not releasing real data to the public. That what they put out there was garbage data. Let's just put it plain and simple. It had no value whatsoever. So once again, spaceweather.com. Enough said. I'm not going to waste more of my valuable show time dealing with those useless people. Okay, spectroscopy. What should a spectrum look like? An atomic spectrum. Now let's go back to the test tube. Let's take a test tube of gas with electrodes at each end. You put a high voltage across it. The current moves through the gas, through the plasma, excites the atoms. The electrons in the atom move up to a higher energy state, and when they drop back down, they give off light at a quantum level, at a very specific level, and that specific amount of energy coming out of the atom, depending on the transition from certain energy levels to other energy levels, that spectrum is characteristic of a certain element, a certain atomic element, or a molecular element. So molecules will give off a very specific spectrum that's different than the component atoms. So say we have carbon, just a specific element of carbon. If you put a carbon gas in a test tube and ran an electrical current, high voltage current, a high voltage, put a high voltage across this, and an electrical current then passes through the tube, you will get characteristic lines of characteristic quantums of light coming out at a very specific wavelength. You then have a calibration based on the understanding of your spectrometer, so you can measure what's the wavelength of that particular line of light, and that's exactly what you call them, because on the spectrograph, that's what happens. You look across, and you'll have no light, and all of a sudden you'll have a spike where there's a lot of light at a certain color, certain frequency, a certain wavelength of light, and that's characteristic of, like, for example, carbon or oxygen. They all have their very specific spectrum that would allow you to identify carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, any of the other elements in the periodic table. If you took them individually, if you start combining these, for example, water has a characteristic spectrum. Carbon monoxide, CO, carbon dioxide, CO2, all of these molecules have characteristic spectrum. So if you put that gas in a test tube, put a high voltage power supply across that test tube, which would drive current through the test tube, the current, the electrons in that current would bump into the atoms, drive up the electrons in the orbiting shells of the atoms and molecules. And when the electrons in the shell drop back down to another energy level, it gives off a very characteristic frequency wavelength of light. And it's indicative of that element or molecule. Okay, now there's one little caveat here. As the molecules get bigger and bigger and bigger, let's say, for example, the big hydrocarbons that we know form in comet tails, it's spectroscopically, the whole molecule does not give off a very good characteristic spectrum. It's very hard with spectroscopy to identify big molecules, but you can identify those smaller pieces, say CH or CH, C2H or whatever in a big hydrocarbon molecule. You can identify the pieces. And so by identifying some of those pieces, you can get an idea that, oh, this is part of a much bigger molecule. We don't know what that bigger molecule is, but it gives you an idea that there are bigger molecules. Okay, so that's the basis of spectroscopy, chemical spectroscopy, and it's the basis for understanding the chemical composition based on the light that's given off. In the example we're using here, are comets. And so the only way you can get line spectrum from chemicals is by this excitation process. You need some form of excitation. Electrons, basically, just like in the test tube, moving through that field of atoms, molecules, etc., to cause the excitation, to cause the atoms, molecules, what have you, to drive them up to excited energy levels, and then when their electrons drop down in their shells, just like in the test tube, the only difference is the comet is out in outer space, in a vacuum of outer space, instead of in the vacuum of a test tube. The evacuated test tube, you take all of the gas out of the test tube and you put the gas that you want to test in the test tube. Drive a current through it by putting a high voltage across it, and it exactly the same situation you have in outer space. Spectroscopy has been studied in comets for ages, but people have really never understood what they were looking at. I've reported this, that in 1996, the decision was made somewhere in the back room of NASA or Standard Science Industry to stop reporting the spectrum of comets because it didn't make any sense. If you looked at the spectral analysis of any comet, by the way, 1996 is when, by mistake, they discovered visually X-rays in comets. There's no reason in the universe why little ice balls should have X-rays being emitted any more than there should be X-rays emitted above cloud tops. Well, if you look at standard science, there are reasons why these things happen. But you have to look at the true energy source, the true electrical currents that are occurring in outer space or above electrical conditions in storm clouds. They are part of a bigger electrical circuit. Okay, so going back to comets now, if you take a spectrum of a comet, what you're going to see is a lot of reflected sunlight. Sunlight, and that's why comets are white. But now let's take and look at a comet that might be blue or green, like Comet Lemon. What's going on with that green tint or the blue tint? I talked weeks ago about the Hopi legends of the blue kachina. And by the way, there's some nutcases running around the internet now saying they've been looking at the blue kachina. And I'm becoming convinced that there is a lot of mind control going on. These people who don't know anything claiming to see the blue kachina, and it's between the clouds And somebody's claiming to have seen the blue kachina from a crater in Costa Rica. Well, I got news for you, people that don't know their geography. Costa Rica is in the northern hemisphere. And so you're not going to see a Planet X object in the southern hemisphere from Costa Rica. Sorry to burst your bubble there, folks. But anyway, that just gives you an idea of the lunacy of what's going on YouTube's on the internet. So just be very aware, beware of all of the goofy claims running around the internet about Planet X or people seeing the blue kachina, you know, things like this. Okay, but at any rate, comets do show blue light. Comet Hale-Bopp was slightly blue, not real blue. Visually, it looked almost pure white, but Comet Hale-Bopp looked slightly blue. Comet Lemon, very green. These are the characteristic colors of the chemicals that make up the comet. Now, also, if you take a spectrum, you take your spectrometer and you place it looking at different parts of the comet, the nucleus area of the comet, which is the brightest part of the comet, is going to be a different color than the tail. Comets colors in comets vary widely amongst from various parts of the comet. So you might have a greenish color out in the tail and a whitish blue color coming from the nuclear area of the comet. The other thing is that in the spectrum of a comet, let's compare the spectrum of a comet to the spectrum of a star. Okay, a star, let's take a star that's relatively still. It's not moving away from us. It's not moving toward us. But what you're seeing in a star is the line spectrum of the chemicals that are in that star. And it's being heated up by the heat in the star is causing the electrons to be excited. Then they drop down, they give off light, and you can see that characteristic wavelength of the elements that are in the star. And they're very narrow lines. They're very narrow spiked vertical line on the spectrograph. But when you look at the spectrum of a comet, and this is what caused in 1996 the scientific community to shut down all release of spectroscopic data of comets. And that's why I'm doing this show. That's why I'm harping on this particular topic over and over again and giving you a lot of detail. If you look at the spectrum of a comet has a characteristic spike on the, but then on the left side, it tapers off kind of, you might call it an exponential type of curve. And so it's curved on the lower wavelength side, on the higher frequency side, and so what's going on is the light, and basically if you know how to read the spectrograph, and of course this is exactly why Standard Science and NASA decided they had to withhold data from comets, spectroscopic data, and of course they're taking this data. They have the Hubble Space Telescope, they have other telescopes. The main instrument on any of these telescopes is a spectrograph. So why wouldn't they release it? Or why would they have spaceweather.com put a ridiculously phony, useless piece of spectroscopic data up on their webpage? Just to pretend they're doing it, like they're really open, they're really showing you the data. But no, they're not. And the reason is because, first of all, you see the line spectra, and by the way, they are not calibrating their spectrographs properly. If they did, they would see that the actual peak is redshifted from the actual laboratory peak. Okay, so what do? You take your test tube in a laboratory, you calibrate your spectrometer. And so the main topic I want to get into now is calibration of a spectrometer. How do you do that? Well, you go into the laboratory, you take your spectrometer, right in front of you is a test tube. It's got carbon, it's got oxygen, another one has oxygen. You have various test tubes with all the variations of chemicals, molecules, etc., that you would find in a comet. And one by one, you calibrate your spectrometer, okay, on this particular line. And so when you get the picture and the final data that from your spectrometer, you can identify what chemicals are in that test tube, and the frequency or the wavelength of light is what you call the calibration. You have a scale, and when that light beam comes in and sits at a particular spot on your graph, on your scale, you say, okay, this is a line from oxygen, here's a line from carbon, here's a line from carbon dioxide, here's a line from carbon monoxide. And you can tell by the intensity of the line, the height of the line, the amount of that chemical that's in the mix. Okay, so that's calibrating your spectrometer in the laboratory. Now you take your spectrometer, it's calibrated, you have all of the elements tabulated. Now you put that spectrometer on your telescope, billion-dollar telescope that we paid for with taxpayer money, and these clowns get to use and fake the data or hide the data from you. That's another crime in itself. But, okay, now you take your calibrated spectrometer and you look at a comet. You put the slit of the spectrometer on a certain part of the comet, and you take the spectrum. The light comes in, it divides out, and falls upon the calibrated spectrometer. And now, to do this properly, you can't fudge the data. You can't move your calibration curve to match what you think is true. And this is what they have been doing. They have been sliding the scale because they don't understand why the data is redshifted. Why is the light from the nuclear area of a comet redshifted? Because there's an electric field there. It's a non-uniform electric field. And I answered that question in my original work back when I was at Cornell, the induced electric dipole redshift. That's another thing I predicted, that the light coming off from the nuclear region of a comet should be redshifted. And that's why when you see the peak, the most intense light coming into the comet, coming from a comet into your spectrometer, the peak is redshifted. And why is that? Because that's where most of the light is coming from. As you come out of the nuclear region and you start going away, the light from that part of the coma is coming from an area that has less and less electric field to pass through, and so it is less and less redshifted, but it is less brilliant because you're getting away from the comet nucleus. The nucleus area of the comet is the brightest area. Okay, so now let's, for example, move out into the tail of the comet. Take your spectroscopic slit and put it across the tail of the comet, and you're going to find that you're not going to have as much of a redshift because it's not charged like the nucleus. The concentration of electric charge is at the nucleus of the comet. So at any rate, this is what you would see in the spectroscopic data. So that's why it's really laughable that spaceweather.com would put up this ridiculously useless piece of spectroscopic data, thinking that they're satisfying the need of the public for spectroscopic data from comets, when it doesn't show anything at all. And it doesn't have a scale. It's I have no idea what these people are thinking. But bad science, poorly reported science, and obviously trying to meet the requirements that I'm putting up. But as my audience becomes educated week after week, you're going to see very clearly that the real spectroscopic data, the real data, is still being hidden behind closed doors. And there's a very good reason, because now you can look at that data, you can see that it's fudged, or if you saw the real data, if they really released real data, you would see that exactly what I'm talking about. The spectroscopic data screams of the McCanny plasma discharge comet model. It just, everything that I talk about, the fact that there are even our the line spectrum at all is a blatant signature of my work, that the Dirty Snowball Comet model should not have any line spectrum at all. Where does it come from? There's no energy source. There's no electric current. There's no reason for a snowball out in outer space to have a line spectrum associated with it. So the fact that it's redshifted is even more blatant. It's even a more blatant signature of exactly what I have been talking about. So why do you think NASA and the boys are hiding that data? Well, because you would see firsthand that I'm right and they're wrong, and you don't need some PhD from Harvard or Cornell or Caltech to hold your hand and tell you that just because they have a badge or degree that they're resting their laurels on. No, you could see this for yourself. You would see that, in fact, the data blatantly points that these are not dirty snowballs, that they are, in fact, the plasma discharge of the solar capacitor, exactly as I'm talking about. This year, we're going to see some big comet activity. I certainly hope this comet Ison pans out, and I'll be talking more and more about that in the future. Hopefully having some better data. I do have some good data on Comet Lemon. The last couple weeks of storm activity have put me kind of basically a couple weeks behind. But I should be back to normal by sometime, hopefully this weekend. And so I apologize for that. I like to keep current with my audience, with my work, and all of the related issues with this program. Just remember, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. The books are there, all of the e-books, the new book, Comets, make sure you have that. Make sure you read it. By the way, there's some information about spectral analysis in that book. And make sure that you are have stocked up on the water filter items. I think this year is going to be a very interesting year. I think we're in for some, I don't really know, but both political and physical issues as far as the world and universe around us are concerned. So once again, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and I will see you next week. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.